Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a while, in certain circles anyway, it seemed there was no limit to how involved and hyper-protective American parenting could become. Helicopter parents went the phrase, hovering everywhere, always from cradle to college. Now comes the pushback, the cry to give the kids some space, even let them fail, and learn this hour On Point how much is too much when it comes to parenting. And what about too little? You can join the conversation. Where's the sweet spot? Are you a helicopter parent? Why? Are you a free-range, give-em-space parent? Why? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Nancy Gibbs. She's editor-at-large at Time Magazine. She wrote Time's current cover story, The Case Against Overparenting, Why Mom and Dad Need to Cut the Strings. You can find that story at time.com and on newsstands. Nancy Gibbs, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Austin, Texas is Carrie Conti. She's a prenatal and perinatal psychologist, an early parenting coach, and teaches classes on slow family living. Carrie Conti, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you both. Nancy Gibbs, you say the insanity grew on us slowly. What is the insanity, Nancy?
Well, when you get to the point that, you know, companies see that there's a business marketing things like knee pads for babies lest they, you know, have a problem while they're crawling, or, you know, hyperallergenic socks, and all of these devices that are designed to make sure that they are absolutely safe at every moment up until the point that you send them to nursery school and have a tutor come to help them learn how to hold a pencil. At some point, the idea that children maybe need a little more space and a little more time to develop at their own pace somehow seem to have gotten lost in the mix there, I think.
Way back, a century ago, you got D.H. Lawrence. Of course, he had no kids, as you report, but saying how to begin to educate a child. First rule, leave him alone. Second rule, leave him alone. Third rule, leave him alone. That is the whole beginning. On the other hand, Nancy, you remind us that Douglas MacArthur's mom, later to become the great general, his mom Pinky moved with him to West Point in 1899, took an apartment near the campus supposedly so she could watch him with a telescope to make sure he was studying. So it's not as though helicopter parenting was born yesterday.
Exactly. And in a way, parenting always goes through these pendulum swings of more or less protective, more or less involved, and swings that are driven by not only, you know, parental impulse, but by demographics, by economics, by all sorts of cultural factors. But I think that in this past generation, we've had a bigger than usual swing. And that because I think of technology and of the fears that a very competitive economy instilled in parents that if they were not there helping their child every step of the way, they were really frightened that their child could be the one left behind, that the likelihood of their child being able to maintain a middle-class lifestyle was becoming harder and harder as manufacturing jobs disappeared, as the information economy took hold. And parents really felt that, you know, if they are not there every step of the way, that they could not expect that their child would be able to maintain the kind of standard of living that they as parents had been able to provide.
But with that hyper drive and hyper attention comes sometimes results that nobody would want to see. You quote college deans describing incoming freshmen lately as crispies and teacups. What do they mean, Nancy?
Crispies are that's the way they describe kids who arrive at college already burned out by all of the activities and pressures that they have been under getting to the point of college. And teacups are the ones that have been so protected, they are so fragile, that they will just break under the least pressure.
That's not any parent's dream of what they want their kids, how they want their kids to end up, I guess.
No, and this is really the irony. I think, you know, that all parents want what's best for their children. None of this is about bad parenting or parents not wanting to do right for their children. But it does, you know, involve probably thinking very hard about the difference between how many of us as parents were raised and what is different now, and about sometimes the counterintuitive, that failure can be fruitful, that boredom can be a necessary step towards creativity, that too much protection can be dangerous. And those can be hard ideas for parents to embrace. But I think what we wanted to do in this article is to just reignite that conversation about whether what we think we are doing that's best for our children really is in their interest.
Nancy Gibbs, stand by in New York. Carrie Conti, you're an early parenting coach in Austin, Texas. How do you see young parents coming in these days? Are they coming in all prepped to be, you know, helicopter parents to smother their kids? You've got a different message. Are they open to it? What are you advising?
People that come are very open, and they're looking for more information. And I think some of the impulse to do what I do really stems from recognizing that we know so much more about child development than we've ever known. And the missing piece in this conversation is recognizing that there's a time for learning and gathering intellectual information, but early life and early family life specifically is really more about helping a child develop emotional intelligence. And so what I help people do in my work is really both understand children from this new way of seeing, okay, we've got to really recognize that they're coming in, and in order for them to learn all sorts of stuff later on, we have to help them really learn how to balance their own nervous systems now and help them develop brains that can manage the ups and downs of life. Mm. And when we miss that by going into hyperdrive and putting them in classes too early and thinking we're not doing enough for them, I think that to me that's a real big piece. So one of the things I do is help educate families about children, and then I also help parents look at their own early issues and their own ways of managing their stress, mm-hmm. because I do think that's influencing what's happening in the day-to-day life with their children.
So you're a champion of what you call slow family life, or some call slow parenting. What mm-hmm. is that compared to helicopter parenting, let's say?
Well, it's really simple. I work with a woman named Bernadette Knoll, and she and I came up with the term slow family living. And all it really means is making the priorities slowing down, connecting, and enjoying family life more. And so, you know, recognizing that in the slowing down and just taking stock in where you are and being more present, you're going to connect more with yourself and with your children. And in that connection is where that emotional health is really nurtured and fostered. And then outside of that, really giving parents permission to really enjoy this process, because it's short, for one, and it's so valuable. And the things that you could give your child by being present with them early on and allowing them to flourish and really making family life a priority, as opposed to expecting that other people outside of you are going to know what's best for you and your children, but really constantly checking in and saying, okay, is this working? Wow, we love soccer and we love all these lessons, but is this working for our children and ourselves? Mm. And then in terms of the unit of the family, is it working? And if it's not right now, what do we need to do to make changes? And to recognize that that's okay to step back, that if you don't get them going early on and push, 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 it doesn't mean they're not going to be successful.
Nancy Gibbs, is there a contradiction between connecting to our kids and helicopter parenting? I mean, some of these kind of helicopter parents we see as joined at the hip with their children, practically taking their exams for them, still there at the registration tables in college. It looks like connection of a kind.
Well, I think of a kind is the key point. What I like about what Carrie does in her class, and I got to sit in with her and a group of parents as they talked about this, mm-hmm. is that it's like they give each other permission to follow their own instincts about what is best for their family, rather than I think parents take in so many messages from other parents, that if you look around and you see that every other parent in the schoolyard has their children in all of these lessons and activities, or is, you know, has hot and cold running tutors or whatever it is, a lot of parents, because it's sort of natural to lack confidence in your own parenting, it's one of the most challenging things people ever do. I think it's very easy to get caught up in a certain orthodoxy of each generation of parents. And one of the things that people like Carrie, I think, are doing is giving parents permission to follow their own instincts rather than think that there is only one right way to be raising your kids and structuring their lives.
When you looked around, Nancy, what are some of the extremes that seem to have become norms, at least in some social circles these days, of parenting?
Well, when I talked to teachers, what I heard over and over again was the pattern of parents acting essentially as their children's attorney, that they would come in and challenge every grade and every test score and challenge principals about, you know, what teacher their child had been assigned to, challenge the coach about what position their child had been put in, and working very hard to make sure that their child never experienced disappointment or failure. And what the teachers say, of course, is the disappointment and failure are not only incidental to learning, they are essential to learning. And so you have a very natural, understandable tension here that of parents, you know, wanting to protect their children and ensure their success, and teachers saying, okay, but that success depends on you getting out of the way. Even though you see a rock in their path, you must not run ahead and remove it. In fact, one of the things I love about this phenomenon is that it is not unique to certain zip codes in the United States or even to the United States. In Scandinavia, they're called curling parents.
Curling as in the sport.
As in the sport. And these are the parents who are sweeping the ice in front of their children to make sure the path is perfectly smooth.
But are you sympathetic at some level? I mean, you know, we hear all these stories about the problems in the schools these days. Surely parents would be on their guard. The international economy is competitive, as is the national economy now.
I mean, you can I am extremely sympathetic. And in fact, I will confess to all sorts of helicoptering myself. It's much easier to talk about the way we would like to get the balance right than to actually make it happen. And to make it even more complicated, the thing that is most damaging to children, and teachers will also tell you this, are the parents who are invisible and who never turn up. So underparenting is a huge problem too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the backlash against over-parenting and the search for the right balance in raising America's kids. Nancy Gibbs is with us, editor-at-large at Time Magazine. Their cover story this week, The Case Against Over-Parenting. She joins us from New York. From Austin, Texas, we're joined by Carrie Conti. She's an early parenting coach there. Let's get a perspective from somebody maybe who's just come through the pipeline. Bill in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Bill.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I think it's a matter of finding that happy medium, as Ms. Conte said, at a younger age, I can see where you want to hover over them and make sure that they're doing the right thing and being a good child. But as they get older, letting them have that social freedom to go out there, try things, even if it necessarily fail, because you see these students that come into college and they don't know what to do when they do bad in class.
Bill, I see you're 24 years old. What was your experience growing up?
I had parents that, when I was young, they did ride me a bit harder than most, but when I got older, they did back off and let me experience things, even if it was a bad experience, such as failure or just not accomplishing something.
When you look back at their style of parenting, when they were on top of you, was that a net good positive for you or not?
I think so. It was just a matter of behavior. I mean, I was told I was one of the better kids back in the day, that I was well-behaved, I was mannerful and whatnot.
And it worked for you, but back off when the time is right. We've got it, and thanks very much for your call, Bill. I want to bring another kind of voice into this conversation from Amherst, Massachusetts. We're joined by Barbara Defoe Whitehead, social historian. She's written a lot about parenthood, family, children. She's co-director of the National Marriage Project at Rutgers has been our guest before. Always great, Barbara. It's wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We value your wise view on this. Now, I'm looking back just this spring. Here you're quoted in the Boston Globe saying, helicopter parenting is a positive style of child rearing. So is it a disaster or is it a great thing?
Well, I think everybody's agreed that there's a very fine line between over-parenting and responsible or attentive parenting, and just striking that balance is, I think, extremely difficult. And I am somewhat sympathetic to parents who now face a lot of challenges in rearing kids, and particularly not the over-parenting parents, but those who have pressures and difficulties and actually fall into maybe a category of under-parenting, not being able to do enough to supervise their kids.
So what are you suggesting a kind of a socioeconomic stratification here?
Yeah, I think that just like so many other things in American society, parenthood is increasingly polarized. So we see these extremes of over-parenting and under-parenting, very protective and not at all protective. If you listen to our president, for example, you hear him pleading with parents to get more involved in the lives of their children. So I would say that this problem of overparenting is indicative of middle to upper class anxieties about, as Nancy Gibbs said, will they make it in this hyper competitive economy and society? And that's what we're seeing for me and for a lot of other parents.
Nancy Gibbs, where do you see the slow parenting movement, people drawing the line between, you know, attentive, caring, loving, and too much overparenting?
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about that I think is crucial here is we've talked a lot about parents' sort of obsession with their children's success. But the other piece of this is an obsession with their physical safety. And this is another thing that I think has really distorted the effort to find that right balance where, you know, so many of today's parents grew up when they were kids, they grew up walking to school alone, being sent outside to play, having much more sort of free play time than today's children have. And one very understandable reason for that is any parent who's turning on cable news in the evening is seeing a nonstop line of stories about some child that has been snatched from the bus stop and horrible, heartbreaking headlines.
But 1969, you remind us, 41% of American kids walking or biking to school. By 2001, just 13%. That's a big whack down.
And now you have neighbors who will literally call the police or child services on parents that they see letting their kids just go to the playground by themselves, as though that is now an act of a very odd parental recklessness. And yet, of course, statistically, kids are safer now. The crime rate has gone down. The rate of death by injury to children has dropped in half. In some ways, it has never been safer to be a child in the United States for most people now. This is not to say that it is that 100% perfect safety is ever possible. But the amount of fear that parents have, to the point that literally this summer, Dear Abby endorsed the idea that every day before your child leaves the house, you should take a picture of them with your cell phone so you have a picture of what they were wearing
every
in
day.
The event.
Oh,
in the event that they get kidnapped, you can immediately tell police this is what they were wearing today. And then if they make it home safe and sound that night, you can delete the photo and take a new one the next morning.
Even though the odds of being snatched are one in I forget what million you describe in the story.
That's right. And so when you have that kind of fear in the minds of parents, I think that that is another ingredient in why it is that it's very, very hard to back off or to slow down or to pull away or to let them have the kind of free playtime and space that was taken for granted for many kids of all regions and incomes in an earlier generation.
Carrie Conti, in Texas, Nancy quotes people saying that we are infantilizing our kids into incompetence, saying 10 is the new 2, sort of infantilizing kids down in maturity and age. Do you see that in your work, in your observation?
I don't see it so much in my work because the people that are choosing to come to me are really, they're open to some new ideas and some different ways of thinking about it. What I think that they're really recognizing, or what I'm seeing in my own work, is that a lot of the fear is reaction to both not just how they were parented, but also just society in general and the way the educational system has been for the past 30 years. And a lot of the belief is that you're not enough. You know, there's a lot of messages that create these deep beliefs of you're not doing enough. You're not going to be enough. Your kids aren't enough. You don't have enough. And so what I'm trying to help people do is look at and question, okay, so I'm thinking I need to do this with my child, or I'm reacting this way to their behavior, and really just stopping and asking why. Where is that coming from? Not just blindly going about and doing what they – basically, a lot of people are in reaction to what they got. So they're saying, well, I definitely don't want my child to feel neglected or abandoned, so I'm going to be right on top of them. But it really doesn't leave as much room for them looking at, okay, what does the child actually need?
Mm-hmm.
And then why is this causing me so much anxiety that's leaving me vulnerable to doing things like this? And what do I actually want to do instead? Mm-hmm. So really helping people recognize that you have to not just say what you don't want to do, but you have to figure out what you do want to do. And that is going to be completely subjective for each person and every family.
But make it deliberate. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, what do you see in your observation of Americans raising their kids, I don't know, in this last decade? Do you see evidence of overparenting in your own world? Like what?
Well, first of all, I just want to say quickly on this question of danger. I do think that there was a time, and most people who grew up in the 50s and 60s can say this, when your parents let you out of the house and said, be home for supper. And if you misbehaved along the way, somebody would call your mother and tell her mm-hmm. before you got home. There were more eyes on the street. And there was a sense that raising kids was somehow shared among the population of mm-hmm. adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you misbehaved, it was okay for someone else, let's say a shopkeeper or, you know, a cop on the street or just a passerby, to intervene and chastise or discipline the child.
Mm-hmm.
Give you a talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was your responsibility as a child to earn the respect of those other adults. So much of that has fallen away. And I think parents feel lonelier. It's more individualistic. And they turn, I think, to the resources of books and literature and a kind of hyper-perfectionism in their own parenting style, rather than seeing this as kind of a broadly shared social responsibility. And I think that's been a big change.
We've got a comment here from the website from Yar saying, we've lost the tribe, extended family that are the eyes and ears that watch and care for children, form a less restrictive environment. Kind of what you're saying right there. Let me get a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Joe. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, how you guys doing?
We're well. What do you see, Joe?
Well, I work in education, and I've been doing this for about 10 years now, and I actually call the teenage generation, I've given them the name Generation E for entitlement, because I believe parents have just the curling effect you guys were talking
about?
Yeah,
the Swedes are sweeping every obstacle out of their way.
Making it so simple for them. And then when they get into their teenage years and they get into their 20s, and I just see what I'm seeing is that they just expect everything to be handed to them. They expect everything to come easy. And I'm also, at the same time, I also blame a lot on the media and television and reality shows. I just think a lot of that just skews their view of the world, and they just feel that they're entitled to too many things.
Generation E from entitlement, we'll talk about how that might be related to parenting style. Here's a web message from Susan saying, there's merit in failure. People, children, learn the best lessons through failure. Failure is a teacher, but not if you never meet it. Dina, of course, everyone will sooner or later. Dina in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dina, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you see, Dina?
I'm an assistant at a Montessori school in town.
Okay.
And part of our curriculum, besides learning math and language and peace, is independence and self-care and teaching the child about being responsible for themselves and their actions and their emotions, and learning how to get through difficulties, and learning how to cope with a crisis.
Now, your parents know that coming in. I'm sure you tell them that before they sign their kids up, but are they ready to actually live with that? Do the parents want their kids to have that experience ultimately?
Well, sure. If they're looking into the Montessori curriculum, hopefully they've done a little bit of background checking on what the curriculum is like. But after a few months, they'll come and visit, and they'll see their 2-year-old cleaning up a spill on the floor, or they'll see their four-year-old talking through, you know, a point with another child, like, hey, you hit me, I don't like that. Or you see them, you know, struggling through something and coming through the other side.
Do you have to tell parents to back off sometimes, Dina?
Well, I think we try to say, give your child an extra second to think about something, or give yourself a minute to just watch and see if they can do it. And if they need help, sure, help them, but give them that couple of seconds to process it.
Yep, we've got it. We thank you for your call, Dina. Nancy Gibbs, is that slow parenting? Is that free-range parenting, giving them that gap for them to flow into and handle a situation themselves?
I think it is, because it involves parents. It's a discipline issue, but in a way it's a parental discipline issue of not following and acting on the impulse to instantly intervene and try to make things better. And there's an appropriate version of this, I think, for every age. And how long you wait or how aggressively you intervene totally depends on, you know, the circumstance and the age of the child. You know, again, I will emphasize that parents who are never there to help out, pick up, support their child, or confer with their teacher about what's going on in the classroom is a real problem as well. But for parents to develop sort of the musculature that they have, that they know when is the time to act and when is the time to wait and watch, I think is very wise counsel.
Let's hear from Detroit, Michigan, and Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that well, regarding the whole safety issue, mm-hmm. I grew up in Russia mm-hmm. when I was younger. We moved when I was 11.
Okay.
And definitely my neighborhood that we lived in most of the time wasn't safe enough for me to go outside alone. But when I went to my grandmother's in the summer, I was one of those kids that left really early in the morning and didn't come back until pretty much late afternoon.
It's a great life.
And, I mean, my grandmother, neither my mother knew how far I went, but I allowed myself a lot of freedom to go.
Yeah.
But I think having that freedom allowed me to also understand my own limitations as far as what I could and couldn't do. And now I'm a mother, pretty relatively new. I have a two-year-old.
Okay.
But I also find myself trying to allow myself as many freedoms for him as I can allow, such as, you know, physically, emotionally, which I also find to be very important. As far as I know, people were talking about not letting their kids fail or, you know, see failure and just try to excel at everything. And I think more than anything, I try to make it a point that from a young age, my son sees failure, such as in mommy does have bad days and people do have fights. But I think it's also really important that if they see those failures, they see how adults deal with them. Because I think that's where most of the teaching comes in, for them to be able to grow up and know their limitations and know if they fail how to properly and constructively deal with that.
And it sounds like you're right on top of it. Carrie Conti, does that line up with your early childhood coaching right there, Anne's experience in Detroit?
Yeah, it really does. She said it very well. And I think that I think there's more and more parents that are opening to these ideas. And really, once you start putting them into practice, you start really reaping the benefits quickly. And where this sort of goes is you recognize that by investing in the early days, you know, the babyhood and the toddlerhood and the early childhood, and really making the emotional intelligence of the child and of the family a priority, you're not just helping the child in the short term, but what you're doing is you're really helping them in the long term, but you're also creating a more connected family. And that's the goal. And I think we've lost sight of that you don't have children just so that you can raise them and then they're off and then you maybe see them on the holidays. The goal is that these are your people and you're going to want to spend time with them and you're going to want to keep growing and learning from each other throughout life. And when I see people doing real attuned and conscious parenting early on, I see them really cultivating these really rich, deep relationships, and they have more trust in themselves and their children so that when it is time to start backing off, it's just a natural process. And it's beautiful, because the shift into a new way of relating can happen in a very natural way where, you know, the child has the skills and the parent begins to trust that, and then the parent doesn't have to hover as much.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the backlash against over-parenting and the search for the right balance in raising America's kids. We've been joined today from Austin, Texas, by early parenting coach Carrie Conti, from Amherst, Massachusetts, by Barbara Defoe Whitehead, social historian, written a lot about parenthood and family and children, and from Time Magazine in New York, Nancy Gibbs. Their cover story is all about this issue this week. You can see it at time.com. Nancy, Carrie, Barbara, we've got a lot of people pitching in here. Here's from online. Scott in Iowa says, these hovering parents are definitely going to regret it in their old age. Hovering children will follow the example set and come back to bite them. I'm not sure what that means, but it doesn't sound fun. Here's Peg, who says she's been teaching college for 20 years. She sees disturbing results of helicopter parenting, especially in upper middle class background kids. She says students have gotten lazy, disrespectful, incredibly entitled. They think their work is brilliant and praiseworthy and cannot handle any form of criticism. That hardly sounds, Barbara, like what parents would set off to create at the beginning of this long road of parenting.
No, exactly. You know, this whole point of entitlement, I think, is worth thinking about. Personally, my kids are grown, but I observe younger parents. And this idea of good job for absolutely everything that young child does seems to me to be one of the symptoms of overparenting, the sense that far from, you know, earning the good opinion of others, you are immediately rewarded for doing things that actually should be expected of you. And this carries on, I think, very much into the older years, you know, high school and especially college, and then into the job market, where it isn't uncommon for first-time kids who've never had a job before because they've had internships and other you know, enrichment activities, asking the prospective employer, how will this job please or suit me?
So these are kids who maybe never had chores, let's say, those sort of
never
daily jobs
chores.
That just need doing, and maybe no special thanks. They just have to be done.
Exactly right. So, you know, I remember I'm the oldest of eight kids. When I told my mom I was bored, she would say, well, I have a lot of laundry you can fold. So, you know, household chores, I think, are really important.
Nancy Gibbs, those hardly show up in your story as well, the sense of the child's obligation in all of this.
And I think that that's a very important one. One of the other things that has happened is because we tend to have kids, and this is partly because of more families having both parents working and working longer hours and, you know, the need to have kids in feeling like they're safe and supervised, that because kids are often doing so many activities, so many more structured sports, so many more enrichment activities, as they're called, that the time for them to either be helping around the house, or the idea of, for teenagers, of, you know, maybe having a part-time job for a certain part of the week, which did have the effect of teaching responsibility and reliability and promptness. Those are just not part of the typical diet for many American teenagers anymore. And I think there's a price that they pay for that, of not encountering actual adult expectation and responsibility until they are well into what we would consider adulthood.
You know, but I can imagine parents saying, well, that's all well and good for you to say, but we know how kids get judged these days, especially in those aspirational families that want their kids on, you know, a high or a middle income path. You know, they're expected to hit all these marks, and if they don't, they won't make the grade, they won't clear the bar, they won't be in that that sort of happy circle, which is harder and harder to get into these days, Nancy. Fine to say back off, but what about our children's fate?
Well, I guess it depends on what you conclude is the most important thing for your child's success and how you define that. And this is where these judgments become very tricky. If you tell me that your child practices the viola 6 hours a day or is up at 4:30 every morning to go to swim team, I don't want to make a judgment about that, because it may mean that your child is a passionate violist or a passionate swimmer, and this is what they love to do, in which case I say, great, that's a fantastic thing that's going to teach them all kinds of wonderful things. But if they're playing the viola all those hours or getting up to go to swim team because you as the parent think that that's their ticket to an Ivy League college, that's where I think at some point this is all going to fall apart. And parents whose own expectations and ambitions for their children are carrying much more weight than their child's actual inclinations or talents or passions, I think that's where you end up getting into a real conflict.
Let them grow their own passion. They'll feel it much more deeply. Elizabeth in Florence, South Carolina. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
I really struggle with this as a parent, and I actually, in my busy Thanksgiving, have tuned into this because it's so interesting, the juxtaposition of keeping our kids safe, meeting their needs, doing as much as we can for them, but then also realizing we don't want to ruin them. We don't want to have too many expectations. We need to give them chores. We need to give them freedom and latitude and certainly opportunities to fail and realize that it's not the end of the world. And that things come back. And I think it is just so difficult in our current world because there are so many things out there that we do need to protect them from, but also so many expectations and competing values and whatnot. And I think a lot of times, I know for me personally, you know, my ego gets in the way. And I need to check myself when I feel that I'm being too much of a helicopter parent and pushing too hard that, you know, it's not about me and how they look or seem or appear, but really, you know, who are they becoming and how are they developing and is it their path? And that is what really helps to keep me in check. But I do, you know, struggle with this. And I also see both sides because I'm a social worker doing different volunteer programs with people who have very different concerns than I have. And so it's just a very interesting juxtaposition and a struggle.
Kathy, you sound extremely self-aware on that front, but self-awareness doesn't make it easy. Barbara Defoe-White, this is kind of right up your alley. I mean, Kathy hardly sounds like an egomaniac. On the other hand, she's self-aware enough to know that her ego gets invested in her children, and you've got to not turn their lives into a form of parental competition.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think there's a bit of a silver lining, particularly in having this conversation, because, you know, parents do, as people have noted, want to do the right thing for their kids. So, you know, just a little vigilance about one's own overparenting obsession might be helpful. And then I think also understanding that we aren't training our children so much to be professionals at anything at 8, 9, or 10 years old. But really, you know, we want them to be good people and to learn to make their way in the world as they grow.
I've got a note here from Joe online saying ego equals bad parenting. I mean, I guess you must have seen this, Barbara, when parents overlook what's best for the kids and do turn it into their own kind of competition.
It's intensely competitive, and I think that drives much of overparenting. People are not really so much thinking about their children's growth and development as wondering and worrying what the parent in their next door or the parent with the brightest kid in the kindergarten class is doing, and there's a drive to try to emulate that or beat that. I think, you know, it's competition among parental peers that drives overparenting to a high degree.
Elizabeth in Florence, it sounds like you've got eyes wide open there, and we wish you good luck with it. Let's get Kathy in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. I've noticed something ironic that's a result of the overparented, entitled students that I see at the university where I teach, that they tend not to, for instance, cancel appointments. They just don't show up. They don't expect any repercussions. And so what I've had to do is, even though they've been overparented perhaps, I have to take a parental role that it's taken me a while to assume, which is to write an email and say, you know, you didn't show up for your appointment. This is rude. Another student could have used the time. Please inform me if you're not going to come. Also, if I have a certain requirement, like bring a copy of your paper when you come to meet with me, and they don't, I've started saying, well, go get one, rather than saying, okay, I'll print it out for you.
Now, Kathy, you're calling from New Haven, Connecticut, some pretty...
Yes, you're familiar with, actually.
Some fairly elite students there, perhaps. And even in that setting, you have to be like the corrective, the reparenting agent?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's taken me a while to, since I think as a parent of children around the age of these college students, I was perhaps too permissive. And so I've had to correct my parenting style, and part of my role with them is as a parent to say, you know, to talk to them about, also to, I haven't done this yet, but a lot of times they write as their greeting, "Hey, Professor." So I think I haven't said anything about that, but I think they need
sounds like you may.
Pardon me?
Sounds like you may soon.
Perhaps your program has made me think about this.
Yeah.
I also want to mention one thing I did right as a parent,
yes.
which is to require my children to write thank you notes, like on paper, when people gave them gifts or did something special for them. And I've noticed now as adults, they still do express appreciation, which I think is satisfying.
Though they no doubt kicked and screamed when you first asked that.
It sometimes took a long time to get that note written.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Kathy, thanks for your call. Nancy Gibbs, what about this? This is, it gets back to the Krispies and teacups and the children coming out the other end of this in terms of their, you know, their satisfaction with themselves in life and in terms of how they interact with the world that they inevitably hit when it's the either university or the ultimately the job world.
Well, this is one of the things that surprised me most in reporting this story was talking to people. I expected, of course, to see the most hovering with the youngest kids and that it would somehow diminish as kids got older. But as I talked to college administrators and professors, there's actually a professor at the University of Texas in Austin who has studied helicopter parenting at the college level of parents, you know, bringing their freshmen and literally, you know, measuring the distance from the dorm room door to the nearest emergency phone. Or, you know, going with them to register for classes and insisting on picking out the classes for their kids. And it being a real challenge to college deans to help educate parents that college is a moment where you, if you haven't already, you really need to start backing off, because otherwise you have professors reporting kids explaining their lateness to class as being because their mother forgot their wake-up call that morning.
Oh, in college.
And
amazing.
So, in college. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that then when you go and talk to employers that they express concern about seeing kids not only with the sense of entitlement, but also who seem not to have the kind of flexibility, creativity, resilience, team building skills that they are looking for in employees. So if you wanted to make the most cynical possible argument to parents, you might say if you really are concerned about your child's success in the global economy, then the skills that they need may not be so much that A in pre-calculus as it is developing, you know, resilience and creativity and resourcefulness and social skills that employers are increasingly going to be looking for.
Somehow I think they will come up with those skills, but it's hardly the goal of parents to get in the way of those developing in the first place. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi. I as someone that has come from, my mother says that she wishes she would have let us fall down more. there have been issues that, you know, I've had to deal with that have been difficult. So I, as a parent now, am trying to let go more and back off.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding is that it's really difficult because There are other parents and sort of a community that rush in if I step back. And so it's almost like being stuck between a rock and a hard place. Because when I let go, other people say, "Well, why? What are you doing?" You know, or
right. What's up with you? What kind of parent are you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Kelly, we hear it. Carrie, first to you in Austin, Texas. Do you see that impulse around young parents when they try to back off? Others say, "Hey, wait a minute, step up, keep an eye on your child."
I do. I think that parents really, unfortunately, are more often blamed than trained in our culture. They, you know, we live in a time where, and it was mentioned before, we've lost the tribe. And so for most of human history, people learned to parent around watching parenting their entire life. So they didn't come to have a baby at 40 and never have held a newborn. And so I think parents have a lot more fear and anxiety of the, whether they're going to do it right and they're going to be successful and they're going to give their kids what they need. and less information about how you actually go about doing that. And that's kind of something that we're really trying to help people gain more skills and more information and just to really trust themselves, because that's a muscle you have to cultivate. And if you were parented in a more helicoptery way, you might not trust yourself as much as if you had been given a lot more freedom, but within that connection and faith and trust in your development.
Barbara, if these things go in waves, do you see us moving on to a different wave now, the pendulum swinging in a different direction, or, you know, are there sort of social and economic reasons that it may not?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. Of course, we have to wait and see. But I do think the pendulum swings, and I do think that we tend to react against, to some greater or lesser degree, the way that we were reared. So, you know, the kids, these over-parented kids may, in fact, through, you know, by the time they're 45 or 50, having their own children, see another way of doing it and impose a little bit more discipline and higher expectations about the kids' obligations on their own children. But, you know, we'll have to wait for a while to see. I do notice that there are warm bonds between parents and their overparented kids that continue for a very long time, and there aren't the kind of divisive family arguments about the war or race that I remember having in my baby boom era with parents. Yeah. So you know, the intergenerational connections may actually remain strong.
Nancy Gibbs, what do you think? We just got half a minute here, but a pendulum swinging? Are we going to see herds and tribes of kids running up and down the streets, no supervisors, no helicopters soon, or no?
Oh, well, I think Barbara makes a great point about the closeness and about that we, you know, we do tend to react to what came before. But I think, again, the important thing is not substituting one orthodoxy for another so much as inviting parents to find what works for them.
It sounds like that's Carrie Conte's message out of Austin, Texas. Carrie, thank you very much for being with us this hour from Austin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Barbara Defoe-Whitehead joining us today from Amherst. It's always great to hear from you, Barbara. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, with the big cover story there, the case against over-parenting, why mom and dad need to cut the strings. Nancy, we love your eye. Thank you very much for the story, and thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Good luck out there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.